Good morning, and may it please the court.
Good morning.
Ms. Wilson. My name is Simon Purnell. I'm the attorney that was appointed to represent Mr. Howard at the trial level. Well, it's actually the lawyer who tried that case. As the court is probably aware, this was an attempted enticement case.
You say you did try it?
I did, Your Honor. And to give you a little background on it, I think Jason Libby was the federal public defender on the case initially. Then he was appointed as a magistrate, and when he withdrew, I was appointed on the case. We proceeded to a bench trial. We'd waived the jury trial in the case, and really the main issues are, you know, outlined in the three issues that I've raised on appeal. The main focus, of course, was whether or not he'd taken a substantial step in committing the offense that he was charged with. In the appeal, though, I'm also addressing the First Amendment issues as well as the vagueness issues. But let me give you a little bit of background on the case. Mr. Howard was arrested in July of 2012. He was arrested for a communication that he'd had over a period of approximately 3 weeks and a day. With an undercover police officer who was in Corpus Christi. She was pretending to be the mother of two children that were under the age of 15, two girls that she claimed to be 11 and 14 years old. In that conversation, which is admittedly...
really, doesn't the narrative begin with the earlier relationship that he had with, is it Gabrielez?
Gabrielez?
Yes. Where he was, he made a number of very direct suggestions to her, et cetera. And when his conversation became much more explicit and sexual, she then was what initiated this. She went to the police, and that initiated this sting operation. So that really is where this begins. If we look at the question of evidence and sufficient to support the findings of the district judge, what do you say about that? I mean, look at what he was doing with her. They were very pointed, very direct. Can you get me a quince? I'm not sure I know what that means.
Quince.
Quince?
15 in Spanish, which suggests someone under the age of 15.
I'm not quite up to speed on some of this terminology, but
it looked like Quince.
Okay, and she said they thought they met a 15-year-old girl for sex, and then so forth, and then they have this conversation. But he presses on about that, and so forth. And my suggestion to you, and this concerns me, that you look at that conversation and you look at his later conversation. Well, the first conversation is not so easily read to be sexual fantasy talk. A conversation with the undercover agent can be read as sexual fantasy, which he abandoned when pushed to take action. So that's my concern, is your argument has a lot of purchase, but it gets in shallow water when it goes back to this first relationship.
Right, and you know, the conversation with Gabriela, she came and testified about it. Even she admitted, or from her perspective anyway, she thought that it was, I'm sorry. And I'm often accused of being soft-spoken at the trial level. And
just move the, yeah.
I'll speak up, but. The conversation with Gabrielis, according to Gabrielis at the trial level, she said, look, it was all fantasy. She said she wanted a sugar daddy. He was sending her pictures of himself. She sent pictures of herself that were very salacious. She didn't think it was anything. Now, when he raised the issue of the child thing, she was like, well, I don't want to have any part of this conversation. Speaks to a police officer, because she worked at City Hall. So she spoke to one of the guards down there, and then they pass her on to...
She was a city worker, too.
She did, the Gabrielis lady.
This was just some sort of online relationship or telephone?
Yes, texting and emailing, that sort of stuff. I think they'd met on the Badu website, which is a legitimate website, social network, where people just go crazy.
Real legitimate to me.
Right. Well, Yes. It's not one of the ones we've identified, or the government has identified, as the ones where we traditionally find my clients. So, but either way, when she became uncomfortable with the conversation, she speaks to this police officer. They pass it on to detective at the Corpus Christi Police Department. She takes over the role and invents this mother. The point, though, is that even though the words seem to suggest the criminality, nothing happened. He didn't have money to give her. He was suggesting he could give her money. He didn't have it and never actually gave her any money. She didn't have any children to offer and never did offer them. So that's why it ends up in...
What's the record show about who the defendant is? I mean, how is he employed and family and so on?
The record showed two different people. The online version was a guy who claimed he was a realtor up in Oregon and Oklahoma. This big money entertainment guy who was very successful. The real Mr. Howard is a failed basketball player. He's 6'7", played in the European League, he played in the Chinese League, and played for some of the secondary workout leagues here in the United States. At the time of the offense, he was injured because of the basketball. He sort of deteriorated down to being a suitcase salesman, I think it was, at one of these department stores, and was unemployed, living in California with his girlfriend, laid up in bed, basically doing this communication by text, which wouldn't be a defense. I mean, just physical impossibility apparently isn't a defense if you look at some of the cases.
In this case, he sent a picture of his private parts. He discussed with this woman, this detective, the possibility of having sex with her two minor daughters. He asked about putting them on birth control. He asked about getting them ready for sex. Why isn't that enough?
Well, if we're talking about whether he's taken that substantial step towards actually doing what we're talking here, the attempt to entice a child to have this illegal sex with him, I think it's not far along the spectrum at all. It's more in a mere preparation, part of the analysis, which is figuring out if there are actually these kids there, which I think everyone, the record shows us that he's constantly probing, trying to figure out if this is for real or not. The police officer testified that she thought, right until the end, that Mr. Howard thought she was a police officer. Mr. Howard testified that he just thought she was some crazy lady doing the same thing he was doing, which is just talking nonsense online. Not only about children, but, he's talking about transsexuals. He's talking about homosexuals. I'd be the first to admit that I disliked the words he used. I disliked what he was saying. He would not be my friend. But is it illegal? I may disagree with what he says, but I'll defend to the death his right to say it. I think Voltaire's biographer said, but did he go that extra, that substantial step that would verify in the minds of, a juror, that he was really going to go through with this?
They're trying to use the criminal doctrine of attempt here is attempting to sort out the individuals who will act out and put them, get them off the street from somebody who's engaged in a lot of fantasy talk or whatever. And that's a difficult line to draw.
Which is sort of where we get into maybe my vagueness argument. Where is it? Because, if we work at it backwards, 2422B has the actual inducement of a child to do something or the attempt. Both are wrapped up in the same statute. So if we suggest that the actual inducement means that you got them to do something, does that mean they actually had the sex or, agreed to have the sex?
Go back to Judge Prado's questions, which I think are very critical questions. But he is asking in his first conversations with
Gabrielle
groom these girls to take actions and so forth. I mean, he's not just talking; he's asking for action. How do you deal with that?
Well, there's two ways. The first one is he didn't believe there were any real children there. That's what he testified about, and I think the detective agreed that he really didn't believe she was for real. Throughout the conversation, I said, I can't believe this is real. I'm just probably walking into a sting, he was saying.
But the district judge has implicitly rejected that, hasn't he?
Judge Rainey?
You tried this a bench trial.
Yes, I did.
I understand why you tried to a bench trial. But
right.
Judge, because your argument, your defense is fairly formalistic. But he had to have rejected that, your characterization of that, in convicting him.
Well, I think he rejected it in a way because he relied on the Lee case. I think he meant the Lee case, which he mentioned when he handed down the verdict. Or no, I'm sorry, during my motion of acquittal. The Lee case is out of the 11th Circuit. Same facts as this case, except in the Lee case, the guy actually sent stuff. He sent little panties to the police officer that he was talking to. He went out to the post office and went to pick up what was apparently child pornography that was sent to him. He left the world of fantasy by doing it. Now, Mr. Howard said, sure, I'm going to bring some panties.
I can't believe you're three quarters of the way through your argument and you don't mention the most crucial defense fact, which is when the corpus officer told him to put up or shut up, he said, take it or leave it. He said, I'll leave it. And then 3 months later, there's a three-month hiatus before the police get to his bed in California.
And that is my most crucial fact.
Yeah, that's why.
Because when I was dragged over to this side of my document by the judges.
I'm not holding him up at the outset, but taking him back.
So, that really is the point. I mean, is this guy... You know, I cited the Gladish case out of the Seventh Circuit, which, you know, talks about T.S. Eliot and the Hollow Man, and is this guy really that guy? The guy that's willing to go that far.
Exposure talking about
that. Yes. Very poetic. And, you know, it really speaks volumes that when he said, look, when he said, let me talk to them. I want to talk to the girls. I want to know that they're real. She says, I'm not letting you talk to them. I'm not going to raise their hopes when you're not even coming. Take it or leave it. He says, I'll leave it. Nobody talks to me that way. And he left it. And then, as you pointed out correctly, nothing happened for those 4 months. You know, when they went and arrested him, they got all his stuff, including the computers and the cell phones. And while the U.S. attorney tried to make the argument that, whoa.
That is consistent with the fact that he then sensed accurately that he was talking to a police officer, and he just shut it down. I mean, that's something in your favor, but it looks to me like that's what happened. He said no. He's talking to a cop.
Or as he testified, he's talking to some crazy lady and she just irritated him and didn't want to be a part of the conversation anymore. Like we saw on the record, he talked about all kinds of crazy stuff, which went all over the place. So I guess really what it ends up being is, you know, we're trying to figure out what the substantial step is. And I think this is an important case for that, because the Broussard case kind of got us there, but didn't take us far enough, I don't think. These facts are as good as they get. You know, you don't have a real victim. He's not even speaking to the purported, you know, victim. He's talking to the mother, who's also a police officer. And we have no movement at all on his part. None of this travel, none of that. So this court has a chance to tell us, you know, what is it? What is it that is sufficient for this substantial step?
Well, all the other cases seem to be people, I mean, you say in Lee, he sent gifts, but I mean, just about all the others were ones where the defendants had traveled.
Yes, and
pretty substantial.
Right, and the court has said travel isn't really necessary, but it's, well, hey, I mean, you're done if you travel. So, I don't really know that the answer is travel is the requirement. I think it has to be more than conversation, though. And that's kind of what we're falling on here. You know, the pattern jury charge gives us this, this idea that there, he has to believe there's an individual who's under the age of 18, okay? Which kind of goes into one of my later arguments, but did he really believe there was a kid there? And in order to figure out if there was a kid there, we have to do some work. We have to...
As Judge Higginbotham said, though, this was a trial before the court, so we're looking at whether there's substantial evidence to support the verdict, and you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, so we have to accept the trial court's interpretation of the evidence.
True, but we also have to define what substantial step means. And I think that's where the issue is here on the appeal. What is a substantial step? What is going from one end of the spectrum of the mere preparation through to something that's considered a substantial step? And I would just suggest that, you know, these facts, they're dangerously close to a line. I don't know what that line is, though. The words that were used were horrendous. I mean, it was to sit in that courtroom and listen to those phone calls and the instant messages and these emails. It was difficult, but just because it's offensive doesn't make it criminal. And I think that's what Congress was trying to avoid when they didn't pass that additional section 2422C that would have criminalized contacting minors for the purpose of having sex. They said no. That's now we're going to be, you know, getting into First Amendment territory. We're not willing to do that. So what's happened is it seems like the executive branch and in part the courts, I guess, by accepting it, have now incorporated that into 2422B. I see my time is up. I do appreciate the questions and your attention to this.
You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
There came a point in time when the investigator decided that they were going to press him to put up or shut up, correct?
Yes.
That says to me that they thought at the time that he hadn't done or said enough, and this is going on and on, so they're just going to push him to see if he would act. And they did that, and he didn't. And then to wait 3 months later and go back and charge him anyway. Why would you push him to act like that if you didn't think other than the fact you just think he didn't have enough? So, I mean, you don't shut down a sting without a reason like that. You didn't go arrest him. If you had enough, you'd just go arrest him. But you wanted to see what he had, if you would act. They were trying to do what they should do, which is find out if this guy really is just running his mouth and engaged in fantasy, or if he is an actor, a potential actor. And when the push came to shove, he said no. And that ended it.
The crime had already been committed at that point. Now, why there was a delay of 3 months to arrest him, I can't speak to that. I have the same record that you do.
Well, if the crime's already done, why would you tell him to put up or shut up? That sounds to me like the very clearly to me that if you didn't think you had enough, you're just going to push the guy and see what happens.
Well, I think that the district court had the benefit, a lot of these recorded conversations, the telephone conversation, the instant messages, things of that nature. Mr. Howard kept pushing and pushing to talk to the children, who, of course, we know didn't exist. And so Detective Escobar, Melinda, would say that she was trying to protect the children and things of that nature. And so it was that type of conversation, and I think it was sort of a defensive measure in relation to the conversation. But as a factual matter and as a legal matter, the crime had already been committed. 2422B focuses on criminalizing an intentional attempt to achieve a mental state. Namely, the minor's assent. If Congress has made a clear choice to criminalize persuasion and the attempt to persuade, not the performance of the acts. The sexual conduct does not have to occur for a crime to have been committed. Instead, the defendant has to intentionally entice the minor to engage in sexual conduct.
But there was no enticement of a minor in this case, was there?
No, there was not. However, this court is clear that an intermediary can be used to achieve that, to have a violation under 2422B, and that occurred here. There's substantial evidence in that regard. I set that out in detail in my brief, but suffice to say here, he repeatedly expressed sexual interest in the girls, and he was grooming them by sending the sexually explicit pictures. He wanted to know what their reaction was. He promised gifts and things of that nature. And the evidence negated any type of fantasy. He preferred the phone and instant messaging over email because he wanted to avoid a trail of evidence, and he said something to that effect. He also wanted Melinda, i.e. Detective Escobar, to delete the prior emails and to speak in code. He would get upset when she would mention the ages of the girls. He also specifically denied on page 338 of the record being all talk. He also expressed concerns about law enforcement from time to time, which, as Detective Escobar said, that the pedophiles will frequently do that because they want to make sure that this is legit and they're not going to get caught, which is often which is pretty normal for lots of criminals. He also, notably, the district court rejected his testimony that it was all fantasy, and of course the district court here was the fact finder. And not only did he find his testimony not credible, but the court had had the benefit of others' testimony, as well as, I mentioned before, the written evidence and the recorded phone calls. So clearly, the evidence would support the district court's finding that there's substantial evidence of guilt or that it wasn't a fantasy. But in relation to the substantial steps, there are some very important facts here. He offered Cabrielis $5,000 if she could find him a child for sex. And when Cabrielis called him back and gave him Melinda's information, Mr. Howard followed up and then contacted Melinda. So at that point, it's gone beyond fantasy.
But he didn't pay a dime.
No, he did not. But just because he hasn't completed the crime, their sexual contact hasn't occurred, and money hasn't been paid, those aren't the elements of the offense under 2422B.
But as we were discussing earlier, where do you draw the line between cyber sex and someone just getting on the phone and talking nasty and all sorts of stuff and actually attempting to do something? How are we going to determine who gets charged and who doesn't if somebody gets on the phone and starts having discussions of this type?
Well, I think it's like many areas of law. You're going to have various principles following the elements of the crimes, and you're going to have to look at the facts. These are clearly fact-driven cases, as you can see from Barlow, Broussard, and all the host of others.
Pretty strong evidence when you string it out, you have all these conversations, and then you finally say to him, "Are you going to do it or not?" And he says, "No." I mean, if he's going to act out, why would he suddenly say no?
I can't speak for Mr. Howard, but as I said before, the crime's already been committed. He may have gotten cold feet. He may have been frustrated that she wouldn't let him talk to the girls. There's a host of reasons, but this court has said that he doesn't have to travel, defendants rather don't have to travel.
When did we say that?
Well, I believe in Broussard, this court said it's never implicitly or explicitly held a substantial. I'm sorry.
Travel is not. It's not an absolute essential. If you have implicit in that is if you otherwise have evidence.
Yeah, Broussard was a gruesome case, as I recall.
Yeah, and I understand Broussard was also under plain error review. And clearly, there's no question that travel is probative. But what we have here that's a little bit different than other cases is...
What did he do other than talk?
Well, for example, he had Melinda put the girls on birth control. Now...
Talk. He said... She had her do that. Nothing happened.
Well, it's easy to say it's talk when we all know that real girls don't exist. But if, in fact, Melinda had been a real mother and had put her daughter on birth control...
Who's going to do this for free? I mean, if this, he's talking to this mother, presumably he's going to pay her for this relationship with the girls. And, I mean, from what we hear in the news, birth control isn't free. I mean, this is all, it's all very sick and perverted, but it's not, just not clear to me that he was doing anything other than, I mean, it's like the two guys in a bar who talk about robbing a bank. Does that mean they're guilty of attempting, you know, taking a substantial step toward robbing a bank?
Well, I think it's a little bit different if somebody's talking about that as opposed to somebody who's followed up by calling, or rather contacting Melinda Posada by email saying, yes, I'm interested in your girl. So he followed up with Cabrielis, and Mr. Purnell made some mention of that, and I would agree that his relationship with Cabrielis, the sexual and the sharing and whatnot, was some type of adult relationship until it crossed into, I'll pay you the $5,000, find me a child. And so when Cabrielis reported back that she had found somebody who we know is Detective Escobar, we are now into the 2422B.
Do most of these online predators in these circumstances adopt entirely fictitious personalities?
I can't say that for certain. I would assume...
The officer might have testified.
I would assume that that is not unusual. Well, she talked about a lot of the profiles of these people, for example, that they often test law... You know, they often test to see if they're law enforcement and things of that nature.
Right.
But what's a little bit different here, too, is he did talk about travel. Now, I realize he didn't actually travel, but he talked repeatedly about coming to Corpus Christi. They had talked about, I believe it was the end of March, the beginning of April, what he would do, the venue that he wanted, and then of course he went into very specific, the, you know, graphics about the actual sexual relationship. But again, the crime occurs by persuading or enticing assent from the minor. And so this court is going to have to look at the I'm sorry?
He said, they said take it or leave it. He said, I leave it. 3 months passed before he was charged. Is the government satisfied that he had no intent to follow through with what he was discussing? You said the crime already of attempt already happened, but it sort of, and I know abandonment is not a defense, but it appears that he had no intent of following through with what discussions took place on the phone.
Well, at least 2 points here. First, they may have had some trouble finding him because he was in California. There was testimony that Rios, who was the first lady, she was the one who was supposed to set him up with her sister, but they decided to have a relationship and met in the adult bookstore in the Dallas area to have sex. So we knew he was in, you know, they knew he was in Dallas then, but apparently he had finally moved to California. So there, that 3 months lapse could be that. I don't know. But in many of these cases, if the court.
Why would you tell him to put up or shut up if you didn't know if you're going to even be able to locate him?
Well, I would assume that they would think they could locate him. You get the IP address.
You suggest to me that you thought you didn't have a case, and so you went put up or shut up. If you had the case, what it turns out, you didn't even know where the person was, and that was the difficulty.
Well, they had to know something because he were looking at airline schedules, right?
Right. And he talked at one point about having been in El Paso and things of that nature. But one thing that's very important here, a lot of the cases do talk about travel, but then they get somewhere and the defendant becomes suspicious. Maybe he sees another adult and takes off or things of that nature. But the crime has still been committed, even though...
Well, that's because he's taken a substantial step in stepping toward the destination.
That's correct. But again, travel can be probative, but it's not determinative.
Well, I think gifts are probative. Money changing hands would be probative.
In Barlow, I believe it was, this court said that even though the defendant had gotten cold feet, that it would not undo the substantial steps he had taken before. Now, I realize these cases are factually different, and each one most likely is going to be different from the other just because of how these things are done.
There's a reason we say put your money where your mouth is.
Well, there was no, as I recall the record, there was no exchange about money between Detective Escobar and Howard at all. The money conversation was with Cabriolas.
Obviously, I meant that rhetorically.
No, I know, but you said who would do this for free. But I do think the papers continue to amaze many of us by the kind of crazy people that are out there. So I think just because money doesn't exchange hands doesn't mean a mother wouldn't do something like that, unfortunate as that may be. But what we have here is, as I said before, he followed up in relation to contacting Melinda Posada. He's the one that initiated the phone calls.
I mean, surely the government, while this sting is in progress, the government can do an investigation of this man and find out whether he's in fact ever been involved in any illicit sexual act crimes, right?
Yes and no. This case is a little bit different, and one of the points that Mr. Purnell had argued was it did not occur over a long period of time. And that is true as opposed to some cases. However, Lundy and I think Nestor I cited in my brief, they also were short. So it could very well be that the government was investigating all that during this time. But I don't know. The records...
I bet you we would have heard about it if he had been guilty of other similar... I mean, they find his old girlfriend, so to speak, and who's an adult.
But as Judge Prado said, we have Judge Rainey as the fact finder who made all these various fact findings and rejected Mr. Howard's testimony or credibility, if you will. But as I think I've detailed the facts in the brief as much as I possibly could and as distasteful as they were, but at the end of the day, the court, you know, there is no travel. And why it became take it or leave it, I think it was the tone of the conversation. Why he didn't come back, she said, Detective Escobar said, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It could be that he got, as I said, nervous or frustrated.
Do they prosecute all the ones who don't?
Your Honor, I don't know. I'm not a trial person, but...
Well, you're responsible for defending the choice to prosecute this person, so I just would like... I mean, it just seems to me with all the real pedophiles and perverts still running about uncaught, you get the guy who's in a bed in California, penniless, without a job, you know. I'm not sorry for the man. He's sick, but...
But the fact that he can't make the sexual contact doesn't mean he can't be guilty of attempt.
But the government ought to be thwarting people whose attempts are likely to result in damage.
Well, with all due respect, if there had been real girls here, they would have been damaged because they would have seen these sexually explicit photos of a grown man. They would have been placed on birth control. Well, certainly the older one would have. Possibly both of them would have then had the birth control changed.
I thought Detective Escobar never confirmed that she was doing that. He was just trying to urge it.
No, she did it. She got a 3-month supply. I can give you the record sites to that, I believe.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. I just.
But then when he said that she had gotten a 3-month supply for the older girl, he said, no, how about a shot? That would be better, and possibly put the younger girl on that as well. He wasn't definitive about that person.
Did she do that?
Did she put him on the shot or the birth?
Did she go out and buy a pill?
Yes. She got a 3-month supply for the older girl. I mean, supposedly.
Supposedly.
I mean, supposedly in relation to the non-existent girl, but yes, it was communicated that she had gotten a 3-month supply for the girl.
I mean, she didn't really get them. She just told him that she had gotten them.
Well, she couldn't really get it because there was no real girl, but yes. So, and that's when he suggested that the shot might be better.
All of that is still equally consistent with just a fantasy game. The district court finds fact, and we accept all those facts that there, but the characterization, the ultimate conclusion as to whether that violates the statute, that is an attempt on the statute, I don't think it's a pure fact question.
You don't think what?
Doesn't come to us as a pure fact question. The character, the conclusion that this individual, not clear to me that it's a pure fact question. We can accept all the facts as found by the district court. He made this call, he said this, she said that, et cetera. But then the question becomes, is this under the statute an attempt, a legal conclusion, such that the person ought to be taken off the street? And I'm not sure that's come to us as a mixed question, ultimate legal question.
I understand what you're saying. What you're saying is, even if you view the evidence in the court in the favor of the government, does that legally constitute a violation of 2422B? And I can appreciate that. I see that my time is almost up. And one thing I'd like to briefly say is I do think this case is different from Gladish, which was just essentially the hot air case, where the court found hot air. But also, briefly, I would encourage this court to join the other six circuits that have upheld the constitutionality of this statute. They have found that the statute is neither broad nor vague, and unless the court has any additional questions.
What do you say about U.S. v. Lee?
Lee, the 11th Circuit case that the district court relied on?
Right.
Lee, he sent pictures to the undercover officer and discussed traveling, but no final plans were made there either. And he was, again, the court pointed out that the defendant was charged with the attempt to achieve the mental state and that the physical proximity was not required. And as I discussed that case in detail in my brief, and Lee is very persuasive authority in that regard.
But in Lee, it stopped when he was arrested. Here, it had stopped already for 3 months, and he'd said, I'm out. Lee was still continuing up to the time of his arrest. Is that correct?
Well, there was no physical proximity. Again, I don't know why he wasn't arrested for 3 months here. I'm sorry, I just can't speak to that. It followed, as the court has pointed out repeatedly, the put up or shut up or take it or leave it or whatever the particular words were. But again,
a lot of difference between stopping when somebody said put up or shut up and he said I won't do it and being arrested.
I understand, but the criminalization is, as I said before, the act of persuasion. So thank you.
All right, thank you.
If I may. Just by way of clarification, Agent Odom was the Homeland Security officer that arrested Mr. Howard, or was part of the investigation leading to his arrest in Los Angeles. And he testified that the way they got him was through his cell phone. They knew that it was a Los Angeles number, and then they tracked him through his IP address. He also said that when they went over there and the marshals arrested him, they had a computer and the cell phones, and the information that they found on those items showed that nothing had happened from the time he broke it off until the time of the arrest. So just to clear that up. The reason he was arrested was because the state of Texas charged him. The state of Texas charged him. The U.S. Attorney's Office didn't pick up the case until maybe 3 months later, when they indicted him in this case, and then the state dropped their case. It's not in the record, but I wonder if it's because of the Texas case, the In Re Lo case, that said, you know, these type of communication cases are problematic.
What was the charge? What was the state offense?
Enticement. It's, you know, the same statute that was found unconstitutional by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
A federal offense calls for a minimum mandatory 10 years.
That's one of the biggest sort of issues I have personally with it, and I don't know that carries any legal bearing. You know, it's a 10-year mandatory minimum for actually enticing a child or attempting to entice a child. If Congress had passed the law as it was originally suggested by the House, you know, as it was originally suggested, to have the subsection C, it would have been a mandatory minimum of 0, max of 5 for this type of offense. So instead, now it's being jammed into 2422B, which has the mandatory minimum of 10. It seems a little ominous, especially in a situation where we have the vagaries of this attempt statute where, well, I know I'm confused. I'm not quite sure where the line is or how to tell my clients that, yes, this is what falls into the attempt.
You don't advise your clients in advance of their conduct, do you?
No, I don't. But
oh, that's good.
No, I... but I certainly advise them on when they're charged and when they choose to plead or go to trial. And I still have some difficulty with it, and I really hope the court will give us some guidance. I mean, I think that's probably the most important thing for me personally, but I'm sure for Mr. Howard it's a whole other issue. So he did get the 10 years, the 120 months, which is basically the high-end, low-end of the guideline, but it was the mandatory minimum. And I believe that's all I have. I really do appreciate the time and appreciate being here. Thank you.
And you're court appointed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, court thanks you for your service.
It's my pleasure.
Very good.
Thank you.